Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, the need for medical interpreters in the Central Valley. A new bill could provide funding to help meet the need. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin has a report. As soon as high-speed rail clears a hurdle, another one seems to pop up. Can the project stay on track? Plus, do you have an idea? The local organization that is sparking creativity. But first, more than 100 languages are spoken in the San Joaquin Valley in area hospitals and doctor's offices. That creates a need for medical interpreters who can bridge the communication and cultural gap between providers and patients. And that need is only expected to increase next year when the Affordable Health Care Act is implemented. A new bill would provide additional funding and support to the Medi-Cal program to provide interpreter services to patients who speak limited English. But could it also help break down the medical and cultural barriers that can lead to health problems? FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reports.
When my Lou Lore translates for a Hmong patient, she can't just repeat the doctor's orders word for word. That's because the Hmong language often doesn't contain advanced medical terminology or names for diseases like diabetes.
Hmong language is a very difficult language that we don't have any dictionary like medical terminology.
Lore has been providing medical interpretation to Hmong and Lao patients for about 30 years, and in Merced for the past decade. Even with her years of experience, she says it can still be challenging to communicate a doctor's message to a patient in a clear and culturally sensitive manner.
Even now, when the doctor tell me something, I kind of go around to explain for the patient to understand exactly what we're talking about. So it's harder for me to think, what do I say? Now what do I explain to the patients?
Medical interpreters like Laura play an important role in the culturally diverse Central Valley. They explain patients' conditions and doctors' recommendations. They act as a cultural liaison between patients and doctors, and often between two worlds. Studies and anecdotes have shown that a trained medical interpreter can have a positive impact on patients' health and sometimes literally be the difference between life and death. Experts predict there will be an even greater demand for their services when the Affordable Care Act is implemented in 2014. The California Pan-Ethnic Health Network estimates that of those people eligible for the expanded Medi-Cal program, more than one-third, or about 500,000 people, will speak English less than very well.
We are going to have a lot more limited English proficient speakers, people who do not speak English very well, come into the healthcare system with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and I think it's a great time to make sure that language services are provided to these patients.
That's Ellen Wu, Executive Director of the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network. She says patients already have the right to ask for a trained medical interpreter at no cost, but many patients and doctors don't request their help. That's one reason her organization supports, in concept, Assembly Bill 1263, authored by Speaker John Perez. The bill would provide medical interpretation services to limited English speakers enrolled in Medi-Cal and reimburse their providers for the service using federal funds.
I think that because a lot of people don't know about it, either the patient doesn't ask or the provider doesn't ask for it. So this bill will bring attention to that right, but also set up a more centralized system for requesting such an interpreter.
Perez's bill would create the Medi-Cal Patient-Centered Communications Program, or Communi-Cal, at the State Department of Healthcare Services. It would also establish a certification process and registry of certified medical interpreters.
We have a real crisis of access to adequate healthcare because of a communication failure.
Speaker Perez.
We're trying to address that issue by making sure that we have a broad-based structured program for medical interpretation so we get the best healthcare outcomes and actually the most affordable healthcare outcomes that come with good real-time communication.
The bill has faced pushback because it allows for collective bargaining for certified medical interpreters. In a recent editorial, the Fresno Bee criticized the bill, saying it would increase financial pressures on the healthcare system. Perez doesn't think that will be a sticking point, though.
The idea of making sure that the medical interpreters have the access to collectively bargain if they choose to is just consistent with my broad-based view that all workers deserve to have that basic right of democracy.
Candace Adam Medefin is the executive director of a group called the Healthy House Within a Match Coalition in Merced. She's very familiar with the intricacies of medical interpretation and the Valley's need for well-trained interpreters.
Merced County, for example, is one of the 10 most ethnically diverse counties in the entire country. And without adequate understanding of the diverse and rich cultures in this area, we can see serious health disparities and serious problems arising in the healthcare arena.
Her organization created a training program for medical interpreters. It focuses on the Valley's major ethnic groups, like the Hmong, Latino, and Punjabi communities. The course features medical terminology, including names for diseases that didn't exist in patients' home countries. For example, she says, Hmong medical interpreters have developed the term sweet blood for diabetes. The course also highlights culturally appropriate care and patient advocacy.
We had a Hmong patient up at the local hospital, and the nurses, he was a new refugee, and the nurses were writing in red, pen on just a chart that was up on his door of his room. And that really frightened him because back home in his culture, that red writing could indicate that you're being, you know, accused of something terrible.
Mailu Lore, the Merced interpreter, says her job is fulfilling. She says her role goes beyond explaining a medical condition or prescription.
I like to help people. I like to talk the way that I like, not to hurt anybody or not to make them sad or not to make them scare the doctor. I really like to comfort them, talk to them, tell them not to be afraid.
Speaker John Perez's bill is awaiting a hearing in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. No matter the outcome of the bill, healthcare interpreters like Mailu Lore will have many more opportunities to connect patients and doctors in the years to come. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Starting next year, millions of people will gain new healthcare coverage under the federal health law. In California, dozens of clinics are gearing up for expansion with new funding to build clinics and expand old ones. But as Pauline Bartolone reports from Sacramento, it may be a challenge to find the physicians to staff the new centers.
Just north of downtown Woodland, the Peterson Clinic runs out of what used to be a one-story county hospital built after World War II. Low-income and uninsured people come here for health care, but not for much longer. The county wants to demolish the building, and that's just fine for CommuniCare CEO Robin Afrheim.
It would be so expensive to make it work the way that we would like to present a community health center. We've been growing a lot over the last number of years, and we also expect a surge of patients that are newly eligible for health coverage. So we need to be ready.
Afrheim says they expect a 25% increase in patients at their Woodland site starting next year under the Affordable Care Act. So she's been working on a grand plan for a facility to serve them. CommuniCare recently broke ground on the construction of a brand new clinic. It's right across the street from Peterson. Afrheim is standing on the sidewalk looking at tractors moving around dirt and debris on an empty plot of land.
And the first time I came on the site, the sound of the tractors was music to my ears.
More than half the money for the new clinic comes from a $5 million federal grant made available through the federal health law.
A year from now, this site's going to have a beautiful new 21,000 square foot building.
The new clinic will not just be bigger, it will have a different model of care. Afrheim says it will be like one-stop shopping, many services, dental, medical, substance abuse treatment, all in one building. This idea of a patient-centered medical home is being advanced under the Obama administration. Dylan Roby with the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research says it's part of a push to improve the quality and efficiency of care.
Health information technology, developing these team-based approaches to care. So there's a little bit more funding designed to enhance the health centers we already have.
Nationwide, the Affordable Care Act allots $11 billion to expand or build new health centers to serve the nation's poor. Roby says these centers help reduce health costs in other areas of the health system.
Investing $1 in a federally qualified health center might end up saving you $2 or $3 in Medicaid claims, in inpatient and emergency room visits, because of the fact that they're enabling patients to avoid those high-dollar, more significant acute care episodes.
Community clinic advocates are thrilled by the federal investment, but there's a problem.
California has a very significant workforce crisis.
Carmela Castellano-Garcia directs the California Primary Care Association. She says a limited supply of family physicians in the state already has community clinics struggling to get the doctors they need. Soon, the problem will get worse.
Community health centers are really feeling this. They are having challenges with recruiting physicians. They are having challenges with retaining physicians as there's increased competition now because everybody's trying to expand and gear up for healthcare reform, not just the community health centers, but the entire healthcare industry is facing the impact of this crisis.
The Affordable Care Act does offer financial incentives to primary care doctors who work in underserved areas. Some may want the stability of a clinic setting as opposed to starting their own private practice. But either way, Castellano-Garcia does expect a bumpy start next year.
In Massachusetts, when the healthcare reform happened, quite frankly, the community health centers were overwhelmed. There was a tremendous demand on them. I actually believe that the community health centers will be quite popular in 2014 as well, and that we will probably be struggling to keep up with the demand.
The federal government says 500,000 more Californians will be served in the new or expanded clinics. How many more physicians will be working in them remains to be seen. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Valley fever has long been perceived as a neglected regional disease. But this week, a Central Valley congressman brought the disease to the attention of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. FM89's Rebecca Plevin reports on Congressman Kevin McCarthy's meeting with the CDC and his short-term and long-term goals for Valley fever.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will visit the San Joaquin Valley later this year to raise Valley fever awareness among public health officials and residents. That's according to Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who had an in-depth meeting with the agency and its director on Monday.
First thing, I got a commitment where they will come to Bakersfield, where we will put on a Valley fever awareness and kind of like a symposium, where we'll bring the doctors in, bring the community in, all that have already been working on it, work on our plan on short-term and long-term so we're all on the same page moving forward.
McCarthy's announcement follows the publication of the Reporting on Health Collaborative's Just One Breath series investigating Valley fever. Valley Public Radio is a member of the collaborative. McCarthy also said the CDC has agreed to perform some initial analysis on the scope and components of a clinical trial to determine the best treatment for the disease. Valley fever is a neglected disease that sickens an estimated 150,000 people every year, mostly in California and Arizona.
What I would like to do first, which we could do in short term, is a randomized clinical trial because there is no facts are proven out there for a best treatment for valley fever. It's still unknown.
He said he would work with the CDC to determine
what would the cost be, what would the size of the sample that we need to do, how large would we need to do it.
McCarthy has enlisted help from CDC Director Dr. Thomas Frieden to write a letter to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. It encourages the office to waive a fee to put an FDA-approved skin test on the market. Allermed, a San Diego firm specializing in skin tests and allergy-related products, has a test to more quickly tell doctors if a patient has been exposed to valley fever. The FDA approved the test in 2011. but the company chose not to bring the test to market because it does not want to pay an annual fee required by the FDA. The FDA could waive the fee, estimated at $628,000, if they believe that the threat to public health is a compelling national issue.
In speaking to the CDC, they see it as part of what I saw as well, that this is a national issue.
To actually fund a clinical trial on a Valley fever treatment or vaccine, McCarthy also suggested creating a prize to incentivize drug makers.
What if we put up a prize for orphan drugs? So then companies can say, hey, it is worthwhile to go after. If we do get it, we could win this prize, right? So you're not predetermining which one, but you send a direction. That's one way. Another way is that you build the awareness that it no longer is viewed as an orphan drug. And that is going through these other steps with the CDC that we're doing now, too. Everything builds upon itself to get you to the vaccine.
McCarthy says he intends to ultimately work with researchers and public health officials to secure funding from the National Institutes of Health for a Valley fever vaccine. For Valley Public Radio and the Reporting on Health Collaborative, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
In a region of the country known for its agriculture and groundbreaking farming techniques, a new sort of innovation is developing. The Fresno Grizzlies, along with Fresno Idea Works, held the first ever Maker Faire in Fresno on Sunday. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero has this report.
It was a regular day at the ballpark. The crack of the bat, the crowd cheering as a player hits a ball out of the stadium, and Parker, the Fresno Grizzlies mascot, making the audience smile between innings. But just outside the stadium, a different sort of event was taking place, one that involved robots, chainsaws, rockets, 3D printers, and more. And no, this isn't a sci-fi movie gone awry in downtown Fresno, but rather a maker fair. Over 33 makers, scientists, welders, knitters, painters, and designers lined the concourse around Chukchansi Park this past Sunday to share their latest piece of creativity. The Fresno Mini Maker Faire, coined the greatest show and tell on earth, was a joint venture between the Fresno Grizzlies and Fresno Idea Works, a local group with a goal to spark innovation in the valley.
We wanted to create a space where people can get together and work on projects together. And so that's what Fresno Idea Works is. And so the Makers Faire is kind of the extension of that, is bringing it to the community, seeing what everyone else is doing, and that we're not alone and that we want to make things.
That was James Thornburg, the president of Fresno Idea Works. The first Maker Faire was held in San Mateo in 2005. Fairs of the same sort have popped up all over the globe, including in New York, the UK, and Tokyo. The events are part science fair, part county fair, and part something entirely new, according to the makers themselves. Last year, the group said some 165,000 people attended the organization's flagship events in New York and the Bay Area. Last month, even the White House hosted a Google Plus Hangout dedicated to the maker movement. Back in Fresno, around 10 local high school robotics teams filled a pavilion at the stadium with robots that can do everything from shooting hoops to pitching a baseball. Chandler Warren is 17 years old and part of the Bird Brains, the Buchanan High School robotics team. His robot throws frisbees.
We had to build the robot in a way that we could pick up frisbees and get frisbees through a feeder slot so our human players can feed our robot with frisbees. And then we had to build a mechanism to shoot the frisbees into goals.
And then there's Steve Dorosky, a carpenter with Monster City Theme Works in Los Banos. Dorosky makes tree houses and pirate ships.
I do chainsaw carving. I do signs, tikis, easy stuff. It's just fun. I'm trying to get people involved in learning how to do it. That's what Idea Works is. I'm actually going to be an instructor there when they open up to do treasure chests and little signs, chainsaw carving. Try to get people who want to learn how to do this to be able to learn how to do this at a place like that.
John Roop was also at the Makers Faire. He is building a replica of downtown Fresno from 1900. His detailed interpretation of what downtown used to be is made out of cardboard, paint, Elmer's glue, and pieces of copper. Roop hopes to preserve the history of downtown Fresno in his models, including a detailed replica of the old Fresno County Courthouse.
During the 20s, the Victorian architecture was viewed as hideous and gaudy, so the more ornate buildings were demolished first in the 20s, and anything that remained they had most of the flourishes removed off of them.
Root made his first scale model of a Victorian home when he was 20 years old.
I've always been fascinated with the architecture that doesn't exist in Fresno anymore. It's just kind of evolved. I wasn't really planning on doing the full-scale street. It was just a hobby.
Roop hopes the Maker Faire and Idea Works help bring about revitalization to downtown Fresno.
I was raised here, and I'm really glad to see that downtown Fresno is starting to get life back into it. It's always been sad to see nobody there and nothing happening in downtown, and it's really nice to see people starting to go back there and development and people starting to move in.
Fresno Idea Works hopes to gather innovators in a part of the city where a hub of innovation once was.
When the space is fully operational, we plan to have everything, full metal shop, full wood shop, full electronics lab, computer lab with CAD, 3D printers, 3D scanners, everything. It's just going to take a little bit of time to get to that point.
And according to Thornburg, the Makers Faire is just the beginning for Fresno Idea Works. The group is creating a nonprofit hackerspace in downtown Fresno where homegrown ideas can become a reality. Already, the sounds of tinkers, welders, sculptors, and idea makers can be heard coming from downtown Fresno. But in a year or two, Thornburg says that a culture of innovation will be in place in the region. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
And to continue that thought that was brought up in Ezra's report, in today's workplace, you know, companies are looking for workers who can create, bring ideas to the table, and help develop that idea. It's called innovation. And the organization in Fresno is prepared to provide thinkers with the tools they need to turn their ideas into a real plan. That organization, as you just heard in that report, is called Fresno Idea Works. And joining me is board member Scott Kramer. Scott, really great to have you here today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Why did you think this was necessary to come up with this organization? First of all, tell me a little bit about the organization and why you thought it was necessary to bring this to the forefront.
Well, it's interesting because the things that spawned it in the first place are kind of self-centered. I want tools. I want a 3D printer. I want a laser cutter. I want a bunch of stuff.
You want all the toys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I can't afford to buy those by myself, and I certainly don't have space to store them all by myself. So I found out about hackerspaces, which are these community workshops, and thought to myself, well, maybe we need one of those here. So I looked around and found like-minded folks, and that was the initial impetus to get the thing started. As we've gone through the process and looked into things more and more elements, more and more angles become apparent. There's community gaps that we need to fill in our community. Fresno doesn't see itself as innovative or technological, and that's really a shame because there are a ton of very, very technical and innovative people out there. They're just working in bubbles because they don't know that the rest of us are here. And so we've been digging those people up and rallying them together, and we've got a pretty sizable community moving now.
How important do you think innovation is?
Innovation is what moves society forward, so it's, you know, critical.
And what do you hope to provide people? You know, what you're saying is you want to bring all of these folks together, people who want to create different things. And you want to bring them together. Are we talking about bringing them together in one place and giving them the tools to do what they need to do, or just kind of bringing all these minds together?
Yeah, it's more about community. Obviously, there's the physical element. There's the get a bunch of people in one shop together so that we can leverage each other's skill sets. We can, when one person gets stuck, another person can help them through that. If somebody needs training, we can offer that, and that'll move all of us forward. But on a bigger scale, there's the question of community. And there's going to be people that aren't going to be interested in being involved with our shop, but they're going to be interested in being involved with us. Fresno City College, for instance, has been just amazing. We had one of our meetings at their prototyping lab. They've opened their doors to us. We had a good number of Fresno City College people, including their departments, participating at the Mini Maker Faire, and that's awesome because even though they're not going to be a part of our shop, even though they're not financially going to be helping us to exist, that community is really important to what we're trying to do.
What you will do is also provide opportunities for their students. You know, if they they can help provide some of the skills, some of the classroom work. But it's just like you said, for many young people, they take robotics in high school, and then after that, there's no place for them to go.
Right, exactly. And if you want to build stuff, even if you're just a hobbyist and you have need for a 3D printer, so you go to City College, you take some classes, and you can use the lab there as long as you're a student. Once you're a student, once you're not a student, rather, you're on your own again. And so we want to provide that opportunity. And if somebody has an idea that doesn't fit within the educational environment, they can come to us. They can be a member at our shop, and they can flesh it out. They can see where it goes. They can find people to help them. They can find partners and potential business ventures. We really have no idea what's going to spring out of this. We're just providing the environment.
When you talk about the tools, because that's one of the things you talked about yourself, you know, you want to be able to use a 3D printer, but people can't afford those. But what you're also talking about are 21st century tools. Mm-hmm. These are things that people really need to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And the learning curve is different. I mean, in the past, if you wanted to take up woodworking, you could just go buy a crosscut saw and a T-square and get started and, you know, roughly build things. Now, before you can even print something on a 3D printer, you have to understand the software that you design the product in before you ever touch the 3D printer. So there's a learning curve there that we hope to be able to fill. We've got people in our organization that teach CAD for a living, and they're going to be on hand to help people over those hurdles.
Where are you at in the process? First of all, you want to provide a physical place for people to come.
Yeah, we've been contacted and we're in the process of putting together a lease on a building down on Broadway next to the Rainbow Ballroom, the old Peerless Pumps building. That's progressing nicely. The building needs some work, so that's being done. It looks like we're going to be signing a lease soon. And so that's the physical space. Everything that we've looked at online and talking to other hackerspaces and community workshops across the state and region, there are concerns. You know, okay, we're going to have this space. Now we need to get some tools. Where do we get the tools? And everybody says, if you build a space, the tools will just show up.
Right.
And the people will just show up. And it's true. We've had meetings, and pretty much every meeting we've had, somebody has come and said, you know, I've got a whole metal shop in my garage, but it's hard to get around. I have to move equipment to use other equipment. Would you mind if I just brought it down to your shop and let you use it, and then I could use it there? We got offered a laser cutter a couple of weeks ago. When we went to look at the building that we're looking at leasing, the guy in charge of the building handed us a 3D printer. So the equipment just shows up, and we're hoping that, you know, we can work with local businesses to find out what they need, what skills they're looking for, and hopefully they've got some old equipment they'd be willing to kick down. And yeah, it's inspiring how much enthusiasm there is.
Well, because there's a huge need.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing, especially when you got in the community, the enthusiasm that you see coming from educators, the enthusiasm from the business community, it shows you that there is a need here, and you're trying to fill a void. And what's interesting is the way you're going about doing it, you know, is that it's your idea. Again, you're creating an idea for something that's going to provide a service to people here in Fresno.
And you know, looking at past successes in Fresno, grassroots really works here. You know, when the people involved believe in something, it's much easier to get the community involved, and those are the projects that really take off here, and we're seeing that firsthand, and it's really cool.
What do you want to happen with the ideas and the creativity that will take place, you know, once you get the shop up and going? You know,
it's really funny.
After they create or develop their idea.
Yeah, somebody came to one of our first outreach events where we were trying to show the public what we were trying to do and asked what our end game was. And I was flummoxed. We don't really have an end game. We just want to provide opportunity, I guess. We want to foster our local geek community. We want to give people access to tools. I hope that something amazing comes of it. I hope that local business and industry grows from it. I hope that all these, you know, wonderful things happen. But really, if we just provide a shop where people can express this outlet, this need to create that is inherent in people in general, I think our mission's accomplished.
And what was the Mini Maker Faire like? Was it just the opportunity, in a way, just to have people who have created things have a showcase for that?
Yeah, it was a chance to show Fresno what Fresno does. It was a chance to give these people who have these hobbies where they work alone for hours and hours and days on end a chance to come out in the light of day and show other people how cool what they do is. It was a chance for the children and the parents of the people attending the event and the ball game to come through and see things that are being made that they maybe didn't know were being made in Fresno. You know, a chance to inspire. And that was our goal, was to have the widest range of activities represented that we could possibly do. So we had everything from urban beekeeping to robotics, from jewelry making to somebody that makes amazing metal sculptures. We wanted to have something there so that anybody who came through would be able to identify with
and
something.
Is that what you're going to provide in your workplace? It'll be for people who are creating different things, you
yes.
know, from either jewelry to some other robotic device.
Yeah, absolutely. We want anybody who has the idea to create something to be able to come and do it. And if they don't know how to get to where they want to get to, we want to help them to get to that spot. We want to offer classes. We want to do seminars. And again, we don't know exactly what shape that's going to take or what the subject matter is going to be. We're building the environment. We're providing, you know, the soil to plant the seeds.
When do you think, or when are you hoping that you're going to be able to officially open Fresno Idea Works?
We are working on the lease and the insurance and all those wonderful, boring things right now. We're hoping to be able to get moved in within the next month. And we've got some...
That's relatively quick.
Quick at this point, yes. It's been.
How long have you been working on this, though?
Actually, that's been relatively quick, too. We had our first... I met James in June of last year. So from then to now, what, 9 months? Is how far...
About ready to be up and going.
Yeah, yeah. And the enthusiasm that we've seen all along has really helped to propel us.
What do you need? How can people get involved and maybe help the process along?
We're about to get our nonprofit status, so donations are always fantastic. other than that, equipment is great. If anybody wants to come down and just be involved and offer their expertise or their knowledge, that's a crucial piece of this as well.
Now, you mentioned having a relationship with Fresno City College, mm-hmm. And maybe some of the other institutions. Do you think you'll have professors, teachers from there maybe share their time?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had people volunteer it already. The president of our board is he runs the CAD program at Merced Community College. So we understand educators. Educators appear to understand what we're trying to accomplish. I think we're going to have a pretty close relationship.
Do you have a place now, either like your website or any place people can go now to start getting themselves familiar with what you do mm-hmm. and to stay updated on your progress and where you're going?
Yeah, we've got a website, and that's FresnoIdeaWorks.org. And the place where we put out the most information is on our Facebook page, and that's Facebook.com/FresnoIdeaWorks. And we post all of our meetings that are going to happen there, and anybody that wants to come to one of our meetings is more than welcome. And we are starting to have some meetings that focus on different activities. Since we're trying to build community, our third Tuesday of the month is now our social/game night kind of meeting. But yeah, it's about building community as much as it's about building the shop.
Well, that sounds great, Scott. Scott Kramer with Fresno Idea Works, new concept starting up here in Fresno, new organization, and it sounds like something that's going to be embraced. Great idea. See, again,
much.
Came from you, right? Nice to have you today.
Thanks, really appreciate your time.
Well, speaking of ideas, another great idea here in Fresno. Well, earlier this spring, the Fresno Food Expo brought together Valley food businesses with regional and national buyers, as well as hundreds of ordinary local residents. But Delray farmer and guest commentator Nikki Matsumoto says all the buzz about food products left her dreaming of something more meaningful, a focus on local food culture.
The cavernous hall of the downtown Fresno Convention Center buzzed last month as doors opened for the third annual Fresno Food Expo. Valley food businesses offered samples of their best products. Crackers, tortillas, spices, dairy products, frozen items, meats, pasta, and dried fruit, to name a few. The people behind the exhibits were as diverse as their products, ranging from small and mid-sized family businesses to huge industrial companies that are already big players in our national food systems. The expo is designed to connect these Valley food businesses with buyers from across the nation. As the buyers trickled in, the room started to churn with conversation, handshaking, sales pitches, and lively exchanges. Underneath the buzz and entrepreneurial chatter, there was clearly a range of agendas for the day. Several exhibitors shared why they came and what they hoped to get out of the day, varying from a general sense of intrigue to Shark Tank ambitions of expanding markets, exporting to new countries, or landing deals with national buyers. The common thread? Everyone was drawn to the expo by a sense of possibility. While I walked and listened, I also thought of who was missing from the expo. Farmers and growers who produce fresh produce were far outnumbered by food manufacturers. A few familiar faces were in the crowd. I chatted with Chiku Tao, representing National Hmong American Farmers, who said that he came to make sure the many contributions of Hmong farmers were not forgotten in the foodscape of our valley. The expo organizers have already recognized this oversight, as next year's event is scheduled for July, specifically so that more fresh produce exhibitors can take part. Hopefully, this also includes small, organic, and sustainable growers. I left the event impressed and digesting my own dose of possibility. There is clearly a lot of value from the expo for businesses and a wider appeal, as evidenced by the 1,000 people who bought tickets for the evening session. But I kept wondering how some of our national food leaders might react. I thought of Michael Pollan, author of In Defense of Food, whose ideas have shaped my thoughts and many others about searching for and growing real food. Food that he says our grandmothers would recognize as food. Food that nourishes humans and sustains our planet. Food that's full of pleasure, and I would add human connection. I don't think that Michael Pollan would find everything at the expo within his definition of the type of food we should defend, like energy drinks. This year's expo was less about food than it was about food products. And those food products were really only vehicles for the larger goal of economic development. I do believe the Central Valley needs economic development, and I believe the Food Expo is facilitating important business conversations. At the same time, I dream of deeper and wider conversations about food. Just one day before the Food Expo, the annual California Small Farm Conference was held just blocks from the convention center. Imagine what connections and discussions could have happened. Just as the expo is fostering growth for many food businesses and connections with regional, national, and international buyers, I hope it can grow its vision of what it might become. I'm hungry for the Valley to emerge as a leader of food culture and policy, and that goes beyond just economic development. I dream of public discussions, research presentations, and conferences about the cultural traditions we enrich and teach through food, about equity in our food systems, and about the sustainability of our farm and ranch lands. I dream of policy summits, health fairs, and gastronomical innovations generated here. The Central Valley could be the place people turn to for cutting-edge good food ideas and practices. I want to celebrate the Fresno Food Expo as a starting place, get drunk on possibility, and plant seeds for more. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Nikiko Masumoto.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Members of the California High-Speed Rail Authority say they are on track to start construction of the project this summer. The authority did clear one big hurdle when it settled a lawsuit with farming interests in Madera and Merced counties. The authority has also selected a builder for the first phase of the bullet train. But there are still lawsuits to be dealt with and lots of other questions. Here to bring us up to date on the high-speed rail project is Fresno Bee reporter Tim Sheehan. He's been covering California's high-speed rail project now for the last 3 years and probably knows his subject better than anybody. Thanks a lot for coming in, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, it seems the Rail Authority has been settling lawsuits like every other week. You know, what's still out there and what, if anything, could at this point derail the project?
The big remaining lawsuit is one that's been filed by some interests in Kings County. One of the residents whose home was in the path of one of the routes through the county, a farmer whose farm is in the path, and the county itself. That one alleges that the entire high-speed rail plan as it's currently incarnated violates Proposition 1A, which is what voters voted for back in 2008 that set up this $10 billion bond measure to help get this thing started.
Now, this lawsuit, as we mentioned with the others, they were able to settle the other lawsuits.
Right. The other three lawsuits up in Madera and Merced counties were, I think, probably philosophically different. Those were alleging violations of the California Environmental Quality Act and defects in the environmental impact reports for the Merced-Fresno section. They were very targeted at whether or not the authority properly assessed all the impacts that the high-speed rail system could have along that route between Madera or between Merced and Fresno, and whether or not the authority was doing enough to make up for those impacts. So that was the point of those lawsuits.
But when you look at Kings County, that one is different, and people have talked about this. It's kind of a personal issue with them.
It got personal. This one, you know, while the other ones I was surprised at the one that settled last week, the Madera and Merced County Farm Bureau suit. I was surprised that it settled because the rhetoric was such that they were going to fight to the end. But it cleared, or it was settled on the eve of the hearing last week. The Kings County lawsuit, I would be shocked if it settled because it has gotten personal. It's been personal down there for about 2 years. Some of the former folks that were with the authority managed to really rub Kings County and their residents the wrong way through a sort of I guess hard-headedness might be the best way to put it. They were bound and determined this is going to be our way or the highway. And that really rubbed people the wrong way. And the new administration has kind of tried to walk back on some of those things.
And they realized, the Rail Authority realized that when they first started this, that they didn't use the best PR.
Yes, definitely. The current chairman, Dan Richard, who lives up in the Bay Area, has acknowledged on numerous occasions that they really could have and should have done more to work more collaboratively with the folks in Kings County. Whether that rhetoric matches up with the actions, I think you would have different opinions. The folks in Kings County say nothing has really changed. We're talking nicer to each other now, but nothing's really getting done.
Well, what could this mean? If you say Kings County, they're not going to settle, could this delay the project? Can we expect a court hearing to come from this?
I think there will be a court. There is a court hearing that's scheduled for the end of May, and that's where a judge will decide who wins and who loses, whether this project is legal according to Prop 1A, as the rail authority would suggest, or whether it violates Prop 1A, as the folks in Kings County would suggest. So it has the potential to knock this thing off the tracks.
But a lot of money has already been spent, and I think why you see the Rail Authority trying to settle a lot of these lawsuits is they are up against a time frame here.
They're very much facing a hard deadline with relation to the federal funds that they've gotten to help get this thing jump-started. The federal government, the Obama administration, has put up about $3 billion, a little over $3 billion for this, and that makes up a little more than half of the $6 billion that they hope to build from Merced to Bakersfield, the initial construction section. In order to not lose that money, that federal money has to be completely expended by the end of September 2017, which means essentially the bulk of this work between Merced and Bakersfield has to be completed by that time or shortly thereafter.
Okay. So that court hearing in May is very important.
I think so. I think so. That one's going to be closely watched by people not only in Kings County here in the Valley,
exactly,
but a lot of project opponents up in the Bay Area who have sort of jumped onto this as well.
Because they'd like to have it start there.
To some extent, yes, and some would like to not have it start at all.
At all.
You've got folks along the peninsula that have been suing to stop this or slow down this project for several years. And to some extent, some of the folks in the plaintiffs in the Kings County case have latched onto some of those arguments. Some of the folks up there have latched onto the Kings County arguments. It's sort of created a little bit of a situation, as I look at it, as the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
So we still have a situation here, even though lots of money has already been spent and a lot of people are vested in this. The way it sounds, this project could still be knocked off track.
It could. I'm in no position to assess whether this lawsuit is going to be successful or not. Mm-hmm. But if it is successful, it has the capacity perhaps to cripple this thing.
Mm. Well, let's move on. And people were surprised that a company has been selected to build the first phase of the train.
Yes, that still has to be formalized. But the bids that came in the early part of last week or late the previous week, there's a $100 million difference between the low bid and the next lowest bidder. And in general, I think three of the bids came in below the engineering estimates of $1.2 to $1.8 billion to build this initial, what is it, about 28 miles.
It's not from Merced to Fresno. It's from Madera to Fresno.
Right. They're going to start at about Avenue 17, which is sort of the northeast edge of Madera. And the initial route goes to American Avenue at the south end of Fresno, coming through the heart of Fresno and downtown.
And building that link is expected to take how long? Now, is that the first phase that they're talking about that has to be finished by 2014?
They need to start that. Collectively, the entire Madera or Merced to Bakersfield stretch has to be done by 2017. It's
okay.
The entire 120, 130-mile stretch that has to be completed by the time that federal deadline is in late 2017. This piece here, once they get it started, they anticipate – the authority anticipates continuing to build southward. Even as this work is going on.
Okay.
So there's not a particular hard and fast completion date for this initial 28-mile section, but obviously they would hope to get it done within a couple of years.
What do we know about the company that I know it still needs to be formalized, but this company that won the bid?
Right. It's a consortium of three different companies. And it's the only one of the five bidding teams where all of the companies are American. Tutor Perini is based up in Sylmar. And then two of the other partners, one is based in Texas and another is based in Pasadena. They're the only company or the only team that is all American. Each of the other four teams had some sort of overseas connections, whether it's Spain or – up in Scandinavia. There's different components, each bringing their expertise.
So does it appear to you that I know it was also one of the lowest bids, but mm-hmm. also the fact that they want an American company to be the builder?
I think each of the teams had to agree to what's called Buy American provisions. So, you know, the parent companies of some of these other teams, the parent companies are overseas. These would be the American divisions of those companies. So to say they're foreign necessarily is not particularly – not exactly precise, but the parent companies of those companies are overseas.
Hasn't there already but you could expect this once a company is awarded the bid, some criticism of that company as far as just their knowledge about building something like this?
Sure. Obviously, nothing like this has been built in the U.S. Tudor Perini, which is the lead company in that consortium, has had experience with large public works projects, and the other two members of their team have also done some extensive projects, and one of the companies has owned some railroads in Texas. So it's not like they're strangers to railroading, but whether any of them have built anything of this scale is very much up in the air.
Why with a project like this that's already under so much scrutiny, it seems to me that you wouldn't want to take that kind of a chance. You'd really want to say, okay, we've got the best, blah, 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 instead mm-hmm. of something that might give people ammunition to criticize.
Sure. I think in that sense, the fact that the price has been so criticized of this project from the start, I think price weighed very heavily in that. The cost of the bids was assessed at 70% of the weight of the evaluation of all the submitted bids. Technical expertise was 30%. And it does raise an eyebrow when you see that Tudor Perini, the winning team, had the lowest technical score, but that was outweighed by the lowness of their price bid. You know, again, they beat the next lowest bidder by $100 million.
Hmm. Okay, I guess that's something to watch there. One of the other developments that we saw within the last week or two, there's been a lot of talk and emphasis about the jobs this could bring to the region in the Central Valley, and the latest being the grant mm-hmm. that Workforce received to start training people.
Right.
Well, not start training people. I would assume that people have been, or they should have been. You're not going to learn this overnight. That
right.
The training has been going on.
Right. I think to a large extent, because there hasn't been a contractor selected and no contract awarded, obviously there's no hiring going on yet. And no particular assessment of the specific types of jobs that these
right.
contractors are going to hire. So until Workforce, the Fresno Workforce Investment Board, gets a sense from the contractor in terms of what are the specific things that you're going to need that we need to train people up for, they're still kind of waiting to get a real true assessment of what are the jobs that the contractor is going to be looking to hire.
Because there's always been this huge concern when you look at our workforce, the fact that so many people were concerned that folks outside of the area mm-hmm. would be brought in and they would get the jobs.
Sure. And even at the announcement of this grant last week, Mayor Ashley Swearingen here in Fresno expressed the concern that that the chief challenge would be finding enough local people to fill the jobs that are going to be needed to do this work here in the Valley because of the nature of our workforce, because we do have perhaps a higher share than we ought to of workers without some of the necessary skills that are anticipated to be necessary for this.
When we talk about necessary skills, because we're talking about – in the beginning, you're going to be talking about construction.
Yeah, and a lot of demolition as well, demolition and hauling away stuff. So you're not really going to get into the heavy construction, but there is also going to be utility relocation, things of that nature.
And I think one of the things too, at least what I have found, is that a lot of this work, even though people think it sounds like, oh, this is just construction, so much of what we do now is just so high tech, I don't care what it is that's involved in the process.
Right.
So.
Building this is not going to be like building a house. And you know, we had a lot of construction workers here in the Valley that were put out of work when the housing bubble burst a few years back. And these are folks that very much would like to get jobs. It's likely going to be a very different type of skill set when it comes to building this high-speed rail system. That's not to say that they can't be brought up to speed during the time that a lot of the clearing, rubbing, and utility relocation is going on. But these are folks that need to get in line now for the training.
Okay. For you, you've been covering this for quite a while.
Sadly, yes.
No, but that's good because we need to have people who are experts in certain subjects, and the more and more you cover it, the more and more you learn about it. Mm-hmm. What are some of your observations as far as just how your relationship has kind of changed or developed with this whole high-speed rail entity and the people involved?
That's an interesting question. It's been an eye-opening experience, that's for sure, because when I first started covering this back in 2010, it's been a very, very fast learning curve because I'd never covered anything like this before. So it's very much been learning on the fly. Being able to converse with the engineers and the authority folks who are trying to put this project together, and being able to comprehend what they're telling me, which in some cases is very technical, and trying to read these environmental impact reports and these technical reports is a challenge to even someone who's been doing this for 25 years.
But I mean to take on that challenge, what I'm saying as a reporter, mm-hmm. because it can be difficult, and this is not an easy topic, and for you to have taken it on. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've spent countless hours poring over documents just to get a good understanding of them for you, so you can tell us about them. But I'm sure the fact that you were able to go with them on their trip to where did they go to?
Actually, that was something that I did on my own, the trip to Spain, which mm-hmm. was late 2011. I had a little bit of help from the authority connecting with the railroad officials and the Ministry of Transportation in Spain. But that was a solo thing. I've not gone with the authority on any of their trips. But, the B and a consortium of
that
other.
That is right.
Yeah. California Watch, which was a group of other newspapers that all pitched in to make that happen. And that was that really cast a new light for me on how the system can work if everything goes well.
Right.
And that's still a huge if. And even Spain's system has had its ups and downs, its problems.
And they've been at it for a while.
At it for a little over 20 years now since their first line opened.
Right. And I think that's one of the things I think for you and to bring the information back to us. And I think maybe even here with what we're trying to do here is having people understand that this is not going to be a quick process and it's probably not going to work right in the beginning and just a lot of different things, because whenever you start something new and this big, you've got to expect that there are going to be some bumps and lumps along
the way.
Sure.
It's not going to happen overnight. And, while you've got opponents saying it will not be a success, you can't predict ahead of time what will or won't happen. If it is a success, it won't happen overnight. If it's a failure, we may have a good idea of that pretty quick, but we won't know that until they actually start operating. And the operations aren't anticipated until, I believe the last time frame I saw was somewhere around 2022, 2023, to actually begin running trains on this system.
Right. And so when I think that's the thing that is hard for people to kind of keep in the back of their minds, that we're talking about a very long process.
Very true. Very definitely. This is not you don't flip a switch and have a train system.
And it's all ready to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Tim Sheehan, for coming in, bringing us up to date on high-speed rail and where we are. And we appreciate you taking the time to really get to understand this for us and helping the public here in Fresno understand as well.
It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero and executive producer Joe Moore. I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.